I once went to visit a friend at the church where she worked as the children's minister. I found her in the Noah Ark-themed nursery. The wall had a giant mural of grinning animals tumbling out of a boat beneath a very large rainbow. Now, I'm not sure, but I'm willing to bet that Noah's Ark is in the top five for Christian nursery themes. Because nothing expresses God's love like mass extermination. I asked my friend if she got nervous telling the story to kids, imagining all the hard questions they would ask about God and death. My friend just laughed. "Nope," she said to me. "They always imagine themselves on the boat." Oh, on the boat. What a difference perspective can make. As an adult, I imagine myself at the bottom of the ocean. As a kid, I imagine myself living in a floating zoo. Trust. Perspective. Bible stories are like prisms. You look at them from a different angle and you see the light reflected in an entirely different way. The story of the Tower of Babel is no different. Most of us are probably familiar with the traditional Christian interpretation, which views the story through the lens of Genesis 3 and the doctrine of original sin. In short, Adam and Eve eat the fruit out of a desire to be more than they are, wanting to transcend creaturehood and become the divine. This single act ignites the flames of pride that smolder in the human heart for generations to come, periodically bursting forth into full-on conflagrations. Think Cain killing Abel, or Lamech boasting of his violence, or the entire world right before the flood. From this perspective, the Tower of Babel is the crowning act of hubris. Two generations after the flood, and they have still learned nothing. The waters did not douse the sin of vanity. Just the opposite. It was fuel to the fire. And now humanity binds together and begins to build a tower to make a name for themselves, a tower that will reach the heavens, making them equal to God. And God's response is swift and just. Tower destroyed, check. Language confused, check. People scattered, check. From this perspective, humanity's unity is a fault because it enables them to not need God. You want to touch the ground and reach the sky as a community? Too bad. This story is the Christian version of the Icarus myth, warning you, if you fly too high, you will get burned. So much for cooperation and creativity as values. The diversity of language and hints of cultures is also a flaw from this point of view, because it was not a part of God's original creation. Or if not a flaw, at the very least an unintended consequence of humanity's punishment. So much for multiculturalism. And now we're starting to see why some people just walk away from the Bible entirely. Stay with me, don't walk away. If this interpretation was the only way to see the Tower of Babel, I would probably walk away too. Good thing, as you use, we have the freedom, if not the mandate, to look through multiple lenses, motivated by the fact that this traditional Christian interpretation doesn't fit our experience of the divine. Many of us have felt the presence of the Spirit, of something life-giving, of something far greater than ourselves, in the creative process, in reconciliation, in the interdependent web of existence, the beauty of which and the strength of which is its diversity. Eliminate the diversity in the web, and life becomes not only less interesting, but impossible to maintain. So what is going on with this story? Well, perhaps the problem is not the story, but the lens. Contemporary interpretations offer us a fresh point of view, starting with the degree to which we zoom in or out. Dana Nolan Fuel, a postmodern theologian, notes that the Tower of Babel has historically been interpreted with what I would call a wide-angle lens. This lens interprets the story universally as the story of the whole world and all of humanity. This angle invokes our sympathies because we assume the builders to be just like us, everyday men and women who want to make something with our lives, who want to be known for our contribution to the whole. The traditional Christian interpretation certainly takes this approach, which of course makes it just seem more unfair to us when the tower gets destroyed. As adults, we don't run into nurseries and knock over the towers that kids are building. Or at least I hope we don't. So why does God feel the need to do that? Fuel argues one possible answer to this question may be found in the story's particularity, which means we need to zoom in to answer the question. This story takes place on the plains of Shinar, which is a not-so-veiled reference to the Babylonian Empire. Well, let's be honest, depending on your biblical knowledge, it may be a very veiled reference to the Babylonian Empire. But the point is, both 2 Kings and the book of Daniel refer to King Nebuchadnezzar, the head of the Babylonian Empire, in connection with Shinar. So the original hearers of this story would have immediately known that the context was the Babylonian Empire. And what do we know about the Babylonian Empire? The empire conquered diverse peoples, including the ancient Israelites. It took away their lands. It forced them to live in a foreign land. It forced them to speak a foreign tongue. It even stripped them of their names and gave them new names in that foreign tongue. And finally, it forced them to become conscripted labor for the king. Genesis was likely written down after the Israelites went into that exile. And the author of Genesis tells us in chapter 11, "Now the whole earth had one language." But wait a minute, in Genesis 10, the genealogy chapters, yes, the ones that everyone skipped that list the long, long, long list of names, it says that each of Noah's sons gave birth to nations, each with its own land and its own language. So why, in the very next chapter, does it say now the whole earth had one language? Because the now referred to is the time of the empire. First Assyria, then Babylon, then Persia, then Greece, conquering the entire known world, then Rome, and on and on and on, an endless stream of empires, and everyone with one language, literally, as in you will speak Babylonian, you will speak Greek, you will speak Latin, you will speak English. And metaphorically, for what do all empires speak in but the language of force and control and fear? And the story says, they said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. And let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens. And we ask, who is the they here? In an empire, who decides that a building project will occur? The king, the nobles, the elite. Oh, and like any politician, they say, let us do this. When what they mean is, you will do this. Making bricks is hard labor. Mining tar is hard labor. Building a tower up to the heavens is hard labor. And in any empire, who does the hard labor? The people at the bottom. But the Lord comes down to see the city and the tower the people were building. The Lord walks among the laborers and sees their lot in life. And God says, if as one people speaking the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. God says, if they have begun to do this, oh God, this is just the beginning. And this is not what she had in mind for her peoples. All of her peoples with all of their languages and all of their cultures and all of their homelands. And so, destroy the tower. Check. A great loss for the empire makers, but a great liberation for the 99%. Confuse the language. Check. The languages of your native lands are restored. Scatter the people. Check. Return home. Some of you to the home you have only dreamed of. Now this is a God I recognize, the God that gives them freedom. Chirut, elintaria, libertad. Now, here's where it gets interesting. If Fuel is right, and I believe she is, and the Tower of Babel references the fall of the Babylonian Empire, there is one big fact this story leaves out, which is this. After the fall of Babylon, not everyone returned home. We know this from the post-exilic prophets who campaigned for the return. A lot of people chose to stay in Babylon. They chose to stay in the crumbling empire. They were given freedom and they stayed put. To understand this, I think it helps if we zoom back out again, not to the traditional Christian interpretation, but to one of the traditional Jewish interpretations, also held nowadays by some contemporary Christians. This wide-angle view also takes in the opening scene in the Garden of Eden, but sees it in a different way. God instructs humanity in Genesis 1 to fill the earth, and in Genesis 2 to till the ground, implying, of course, that they were always meant to leave the garden. You can't very well till the earth and stay in your backyard. You also can't till the ground when it's already been tilled, and Eden sounds nothing if not well tilled. So God wants humanity to go out into the world, just like parents want their children to eventually leave the house. God just wasn't planning on it happening quite so soon. But who is ever ready for the kids to leave the nest? From this point of view, Genesis 1 through 10 is all about God figuring out how to parent humanity, and sometimes getting it wrong. Sometimes she is a little too laissez-faire. Think, hey, Cain, where's your brother? And sometimes she is a little too much of a disciplinarian. Think, hey, when's this rain gonna let up? But by Genesis 11, she has finally figured it out. The destruction of the tower is her nudge in the right direction. And that direction is outward. People are meant to fill the earth, to go onward, outward, in new directions, to seek new places, new relationships, new ways of being. But instead, they get scared and stick together with the people they already know. They hole up. They start building walls to keep themselves safe, to keep themselves in, and perhaps unintentionally to keep others out. And I have to admit, I can relate to this. I do not like to go to new places and meet new people. My introverted side kicks in and I begin panicking. Just a few months ago, I went to a book club for the first time, and the only way I even made myself go is by convincing myself that I knew the woman hosting it. I got there and realized that I did not know her. In fact, I knew no one there. Panic, panic. If I wasn't so comfortable with books, I would have run screaming from the room. Of course, it went fine. I had a good time. But still, getting there was terrifying. And I'm pretty sure the spirit has got bigger things in mind than book club. Terrifying. I get it. Holing up and building a tower sounds good to me. It will be a watchtower. That way we can see from real far off all the terrible things that are coming to get us. Pretty fear-based. But in one rabbinic interpretation, the reason given for building the tower is even more fear-based than this. The rabbi says they were building a tower to hold up the sky to keep it from falling. They had plans to build three more, one in each corner. But hey, I can relate to this too. How many times have I convinced myself of a future catastrophe just so I can start solving problems I don't even have and have never had? I call them my backup plans, and I've got way more than four. Or how many times have I not been able to let go of a past problem, so I keep trying to solve a problem that no longer exists? Well, Bob, I know you said that was no longer a problem, but just in case, I was thinking, and the past plays on repeat again and again and again. This too does not make me original. The generation that built the tower were only two generations removed from the flood. A number of rabbis say these people built the tower to avoid the next flood. God said she wouldn't do it again, but they couldn't trust in God, so they got to work. We can save ourselves next time, they thought. And hey, I bet a lot of us can relate to that. In fact, I'm pretty sure the entire self-help industry is predicated on this notion. Perhaps we try so hard to lift ourselves up because we are afraid. There is nothing else out there, nothing bigger than ourselves, that will lift us up in our times of trouble. And maybe we think if we build the walls high enough, the trouble won't be able to reach us this time. Or we become cautious people and we say, we'll do nothing until we can be sure. We do not venture out. We do not risk the ocean. We ignore the still small voice inside that whispers that we were meant to do something more, that we weren't meant just to survive. Because when we think in terms of survival, we are thinking from a place of fear. We become rigid. We ask, if we set sail, will we sink or will we float? The world becomes black and white, yes and no. And we all want the answers before the trip even begins. But that is not how an adventure works. Adventures require risk. Rumi says, merchants know better. If you do nothing, you lose. Don't be one of those merchants who won't risk the ocean. You must set fire to have light. And have no doubt we are all called to be adventurers, to tumble out of boats with grins on our faces beneath rainbows at night. Okay, it might not be quite that happy, but it will be joyful. It will bring us life, not death, hope, not fear. It will feel like coming home to a place we have never been before. It will feel like we are speaking the language our mouths were made for. And as a result, the whole earth, meaning way out there, not just in here, will begin to flower. Eden will be made new again. And we will trust one another and use for good our power. We will find ourselves not locked behind our walls or hidden in towers, but free. We will find ourselves in freedom land, and we will know the true meaning of freedom, Chevrut, Eleftheria, Libertad, surrender.